David Hunt, President and CEO of PGIM, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, fantastic. Now, you join us during Citywire's 25th year. So I wanted to start this conversation by asking you for some reflections. Now, I know you've not been at PGIM quite that long, but, you know, looking back at your period at the organisation and beyond, and in those that quarter of a century, what are your reflections on how financial services and asset management have changed?
Yeah, well, first of all, congratulations to you and your colleagues on 25 years. I think that's a really an impressive milestone. And you have been covering the industry during some time of, I think, really rapid change. You know, I've been in my role for 12 years, but I've been in the industry for over 30. And, you know, during that time, it really has gone from what I would almost call a craft industry, which was, you know, mostly relatively small firms that were highly specialized in particular asset classes, to a world now which looks fundamentally different. You know, we have, for the most part, a widening gap between the firms that are doing well and the ones that are struggling. And the ones that are doing well tend to be large, global, and generally fairly diversified. And I would say that they're kind of three different types of firms that are doing well. One has been some of the big passive firms, where they have really driven a lot of assets into indexing and into passive ETFs. Another group has been the private alternatives, who many of them started in private equity, but they've moved into real estate and private credit. They've also grown really rapidly and become real global players in their own right. And then you have players like PGIM, who are, you know, large global, but we actually do both private and public asset classes. We're active managers. We live and die on our investment performance, but we're able to fully kind of cover the needs of most institutional clients. And that's been particularly important as we move more towards solutions. But what those three groups of players have done, as they have been winning, is that if you were just in one asset class, or you're just operating in one country, or you're just a long-only player, you're actually struggling. Now, it isn't actually consolidating in that we probably have more asset managers than we've had before. But the disparity between profitability and fundraising and flows between the three groups that I mentioned and everybody else is growing and growing. And I think that's going to continue.
That's really interesting. If you're a mid-sized asset manager, your advice would be grow quick, broaden your waterfront right now.
You really need to, because the public and the private markets are coming together. I mean, it used to be that, if we go back in history, that the private markets, they had their own media coverage, they had their own analyst coverage. It was almost like a separate world. And now what we see is that these worlds are coming together, and clients are saying, we want you to choose the relative value between public and private. And we want you to combine a private credit with public, or we want infrastructure, and we want that to be partly debt, partly equity. Some of it will be public, some of it will be private. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that you kind of have a separation between the old long only and private doesn't work anymore. And therefore, you know, I think the winning model is going to have both.
Now, let's talk straight away about private then.
Sure.
And I know, you know, yeah, you've got a big business, and I'm looking at some recent activity in Europe, some LTIF launch recently. I suppose the first question is, what is driving this trend? Spoke to people this week about selling alts to the wealth market. What's driving this appetite? You're talking about clients who are looking to an asset manager like yourself and saying, you choose. But why is that question occurring in a way that it didn't so much before?
So really, large, sophisticated institutional investors are allocating more and more to privates. And in the early days, that largely meant private equity. And effectively, they decided that private equity was better on a risk-adjusted basis than public equities, and they moved money into that. Real estate has always been a big holding, and that's grown as well. But the big change, I would say, has been private credit, which over the last decade, it's been our fastest growing business. We're a very large private credit player, but it has been for others as well. And part of the reason for that is that after the GFC, banks really pulled back from lending. They stopped lending the way they did into the middle market. They've stopped being as active in asset-based finance. They've stopped being as active in project finance and infrastructure. And so LPs and GPs and asset managers such as ourselves have really stepped in to provide the funding for that. And that's a huge change in actually how the economy is funded. And it's meant there's a huge opportunity for asset owners to be funding that part from private portfolios. So this is a trend I think that will continue, and we will have a higher allocation in 5 years, I would say, than we do now to private alternatives.
Yeah, so, you know, Citywire, certainly here in the UK and also globally, so much of what we do is to write for the wealth market. The big questions are about the suitability of some of these private markets investments. I know they come in different flavors for that segment. And along with that, you know, a segment that may want this stuff, but is also asking for things like liquidity, that wasn't sort of traditionally demanded in that way. So it'd be great to hear what your take on that is, because from our point of view, there is such a push to for this market to embrace alts investments.
Yes, I mean, in a strange way, if you look at the returns that have been available to the institutional market, I think both high net worth, but even more broadly retail, would like to have access to some of that that alpha. Now, as you point out, part of that alpha is being generated as a liquidity premium, because there's no question that part of what you're being paid for is the fact that these aren't as liquid. So our challenge as an asset manager is, how do we find the right vehicles and packages that will provide enough liquidity to a high net worth individual, but still retain the alpha generation quality to that? And you know, I think we've made good progress over the last couple of years as an industry. More needs to be done if we're truly going to democratize this. But you will see, I think, a greater share of high net worth dollars going in to private alternatives over the next couple of years as we get more and more familiar with some of these drawdown vehicles.
Mm. Now, you talked about winners and losers in asset management writ large. In the private market sphere, you're hoping to be a winner. You are a winner. But what will be the defining characteristics of people who do win in this market, considering there are players who are trying to build up their capability there?
So you remember in my groups of winners, one of them was private alternatives, who were really only in private alternatives. They started in private equity, but they've moved into others. They have also been pushing into high net worth for sure, and I think done a nice job of it. The group that PGIM is in, and I think what we're weird is that we do private. So we have over $300 billion in private alternatives. We're one of the largest in the world. But we also do long only. So what we can do is we can take public and private together and create solutions that use relative value trading across that, which for many pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, endowments and foundations, they want to be able to invest across that. And the private alternatives people who only do that don't have that ability, or at least not yet.
Moving on from private markets, back to sort of the big picture, I suppose. And we're reflecting on things that have changed in the 25 years. But at the moment, you know, the world seems to be going through more change than ever.
Absolutely.
So, you know, not than ever, but more it's front that those 25 years, certainly the last few years, things have become more volatile. And so I suppose, you know, with, you know, there's divergent stories among world economies and among central banks. What is your outlook for the global economy? And how will that influence global fund flows, I suppose.
So let me take the first part of your question a little bit separately, which is that the last couple of years have been really predominated by some pretty very large idiosyncratic risks. And whether it was the global pandemic, two wars that people didn't really see coming, rather than by the traditional business cycle. And that's led a lot of people to say, wow, are geopolitics and other things becoming a bigger risk than they have been before? Mm-hmm. And our answer to that is that actually not. they are going back to normal, and that it's actually been the last 15 years, which has been remarkably, remarkably stable, that are the aberration. But if we go back, you know, really to the time since the Second World War, we would see that these kinds of shifts and changes and alliances and, unfortunately, you know, regional skirmishes are actually pretty much the norm. So we would say we're going back to a world where we will have more idiosyncratic risk, but that is what we get paid to do. That is part of the risk premium that we get paid to do. So we need to construct portfolios that account for this kind of risk. And in general, those portfolios are going to look a little bit different. They're going to have a little bit more privates to them, but they are also going to have more liquidity in them, because you need liquidity to be able to move when some of these events happen. And that's very different from the thinking that kind of the biggest risk was the business cycle. And we would have, you know, a big argument about, well, are we going to have a recession? We're not a recession. I actually get that question much less now than I do about how do you see the U.S.-China, you know, relationship playing out and what's happening to global supply chains. Mm-hmm. So those are, I think, the biggest risks that people are focused on. You know, to your question around growth, the answer is that it's highly divergent. Being here in the UK and on the continent some over the last 10 days, you know, growth is actually pretty hard to come by. The EU overall isn't any larger today than it was in 2018. Mm. You know, on the other hand, last month I was in Japan, and you've never seen such a bouncy group of people. Inflation is finally back, growth is back, the stock market's hit an all-time high. And probably Japan has been the biggest beneficiary of the tension between the U.S. And China. You see a lot of the emerging markets where the supply chains are actually growing, whether that's Indonesia, Vietnam, Mexico, doing pretty well. China, really struggling. Yes, the official growth rate is 5%, but there's really no international capital at this point that's going into China. And then you come to the U.S., where, you know, a year ago people were saying, well, maybe there'll be a recession and, you know, will we have a soft landing? And here we find ourselves better than a soft landing. We actually have growth has been reasonably robust. The labor market's in very good shape. Inflation remains a little bit stubbornly high. But overall, actually, the markets and the economy are in good shape. So the net of that is that I would say money is being reallocated away from Europe. It's going into Japan and into these other emerging markets, which are beneficiaries of the supply chain. It's going into the U.S., and it's not going into China at this point. So you are seeing a real reallocation of global flows than if you'd asked me that just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, how do you respond to that as an asset manager? Is it simply about having a strategy, having a really broad waterfront of strategy sort of geographically? And sort of, you know, encouraging those geographic allocations where they might not have been before, because we're used to a world of EM, you know, global.
It is. I mean, we really don't like the emerging markets nomenclature at all. I mean, it's a very strange world where, you know, South Korea, China, and Argentina are linked together, right? Mm-hmm. So we are much more surgical when we do this kind of analysis about what are the countries that are benefiting from the supply changes? What are countries that are benefiting from some of the changes in energy prices? And how do those fit into the portfolio? But the net of it, as you point out, is that the broad geographical diversification of our clients is much greater now than it was a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And that is actually, I think, going to be better for returns and certainly better for risks.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, noting from conversations with selectors and others, you know, they can have that, you know, can have a diverse allocation, but not in the kind of country-specific way that they needed to in a different way. You're obviously a big organization, but for yourself and others, you have to be pretty fleet of foot in terms of launching products to respond to what's going on, because that can be a long process. And certainly, there's investors who are used to biding their time before they back a product. That might need to change.
It's a great point. We manage $1.3 trillion on behalf of clients. And that sounds like a lot of money, but when you break it down into asset class and into strategies, it does get to a universe where that does need to be, you know, really actively managed. I'll give you an easy example is what's happening in the U.S. to mutual funds. So, you know, people have been saying, gee, mutual funds are on the decline ever since I started in the industry. And that's really not true. They're actually doing fine. But flows are going into other vehicles. So we're seeing active ETFs are, you know, growing much faster. We're seeing separately managed accounts. We're seeing CITs. So the diversity of vehicles that we're seeing on the retail side is much greater. And it is likely that in 5 years, we will have much more flows going into things like ETFs. So we as an asset manager need to be investing in the product development so that we pivot ahead of our clients' needs to be able to offer those. And that's a core challenge for us as a leading asset manager.
And just to ask you about that, do you think, honestly, we will see the expansion of active ETFs in Europe that we've seen in the US? Obviously, because there aren't those tax drivers, for example, but because of some of the other reasons you're outlining.
Over time, yes. I think it will happen more slowly in Europe than what we're seeing now, which has been quite a pretty steep pickup in the U.S. Partly that's the tax issues, but there are other benefits. I mean, people do like the fact that they can, you know, trade during the day. They like the convenience of that. They do actually like the create option that you have with ETFs. And in general, they are a very efficient vehicle from a cost point of view. So I think over time, it'll happen slowly as these things do. But over time, yes, I think the share of that will grow in Europe as well.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you. And I suppose one final question on this sort of phase of the conversation was just to ask about sustainability, actually. Because I know you've launched a decarbonisation fund, I think last summer. I think speaking to some of your folk in distribution, that's done really well. There's been a lot of interest in it, certainly. But yeah, you know, there's been talk about, you know, of a rewiring of the economy. And you, as you said, you're there post-COVID and with war and geopolitics and so on. Just really interesting to get your view on that, on how you're responding to these changes, you know, that are to do with sustainability, that are to do with renewables, that are to do with all these sort of transition, these sort of big wheels that are turning at the moment. I've mentioned one product, but in bigger terms.
No, I'm really glad you've brought that up. Well, because I think it is important, and we've in fact just published a big piece on energy transition, because I think that we felt that the whole conversation 2 years ago was very. Lacked a lot of nuance. There was kind of, you know, good technologies and bad technologies, and there was bad things that were happening in the brown space and good things that were happening in the green space. And not a lot of sense of this is going to be a long, difficult journey to decarbonization. And there are fundamental trade-offs between growth, price, and climate that are going to need to be made in all of this. And we actually think that conversations move forward a lot. We would say that there's more, we call it ESG with integrity, but you know, much more of a fact-based knowledge now about how this needs to be built into portfolios than there was a couple of years ago, where I think there was a lot of hand-waving, but maybe not as much substance. And I think we've got back to substance, which I think we really believe in the way that we manage money, and we have, you know, deeply embedded in our investment philosophy and in our processes, the notion that as a fiduciary, ESG risks are really, really important, and sustainability is important beyond that to certain types of clients, particularly in Europe.
Yeah. You know, some asset managers hold themselves out as specialists or are known to be specialists in sustainability, you know, maybe from the day they began, the way they're founded. They're not as big as you. But do you feel like you've been doing this long enough, deeply enough to be ranked alongside them?
I think that we have, and I think particularly because we've been managing money in Europe for a very long time. I think that unlike a lot of other American managers, we do feel that we have kind of our roots maybe more deeply in that. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, though, we are very acknowledged that this is our clients' money, not ours. And so I always find it a bit strange when people hold themselves out as if it's their decision. We're advisors. We manage our money as our clients would like to. Our obligation is to provide them the strategies, the tools, the ability to measure that so that they can express their own values, whether or not that's ESG or actually other social factors, in the way that they want. And so being a fiduciary does mean that it's your client's decision and you manage money the way that they want to have their money managed.
That's a good answer. Right. Well, we're going to turn to bonds now.
Fascinating. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Hey, I know a lot of very interesting bond fund managers. So, you know, the phrase bonds are back. Don't know who coined it. Did you coin it?
I doubt very much.
Yeah, very much.
But
claim that you have. Yeah. But look, you know, this story has been developing, you know, for a while. But, you know, there's so much money has been sat in money markets. Talking to all the distribution people I know at the beginning of this year, there's a lot of money sat on the sidelines. But when it comes to fixed income, I'd just love to hear sort of your view of what you've seen happening, that, you know, are bonds back? has that story played out? What and you know, where you're looking at the world, what's happening with rates? Where do you see that going in the next year or so? Where's that story? Bonds are back. Where next?
So I do think that the bonds are back thesis is right, but I think that it's been covered probably not sufficiently deeply. So at a superficial level, there's no question that cash has really looked very good, and it won't be until you really do see rates begin to come down that people will go, I think I want a little duration, please. And so you will see that move. But there are two much more fundamental things that are happening, which I think are much more secular in nature. One of them is, as you have higher rates, pension funds are better funded. So they're actually, feeling very good about where they are now, which means that they are taking risk off the table. They're actually, most of them are on a glide path of some kind. That means they are moving money out of risk assets and into fixed income as they actually get better funded. So we're seeing that phenomena, not just here in the UK, but right around the world. And the second one is that the demographics are such that particularly in the developed world, it's aging. People need income. And so retirement income is a major, major trend, which requires a movement into bonds. Mm-hmm. And it'll have lots of different shapes and forms, and some of it will come with an annuity or guarantees, others of it will be pure capital markets. But the need for income is actually growing rapidly as people retire. And so yes, you have this kind of notion of people will move out of money market funds, but I think more fundamentally you have these other two big trends, which means in 5 years you will absolutely have seen a big shift of money back into bonds.
So you mentioned retirement and aging population.
Yeah,
it's so important. We've got elections at the moment. Is it being talked about enough? I certainly have heard asset managers talk about pensions, looking after people's saving as a very sort of core founding reason for existence. Obviously, an incredibly important part of the job. Be great to hear from you. You know, as I say, demographics change, this aging population. How, apart from this shift to fixed income, the investment industry is going to meet those challenges as time goes, and meet the challenges of income for the people who are retiring now in the next few years, and the challenges of that maybe longer working lifespan, making savings go further, that we're going to see in the future.
Boy, there's a lot to unpack fundamentally, not only do you have the aging and demographics, but you have the pension system changing as well. I mean, if you go back again 30 years, most people had a DB scheme, and things were kind of professionally managed, and people could kind of count on a check. You know, that's not really true today. Many of those schemes are now closed. Many more people are in DC plans. The U.S. was fairly early to moving into the DC kind of world. And unfortunately, defined contribution has not lived up, I would say, to what it really needs to do. In the U.S., we have 40 million people that do not have access to a retirement account. I mean, that is a stunning number. So we can argue about whether there's enough of them or invested in fixed income. But first of all, we just need to have a set of plans that everybody can be part of and everybody can start saving from a young age that has some kind of matching to do that. And we don't have that now. You know, here in the UK, obviously, you've got, plans that are growing quite rapidly. And you have, I think, an opportunity now to learn from some of the mistakes that have been made in the US in formulating, I think, a better DC plan. And I think a lot has been learned from what the Australians have done, what the Canadians have done, who've taken in many ways the best parts of what a DB plan offers, some of the risk sharing and others, and made that available on an individual basis. And I think we need to be headed in that if we are going to close the retirement gap that many countries around the world have.
Yeah, for sure. Moving on, Situr has a business out in Asia. And so I thought it'd be really interesting to talk to you about that market out there. It'd just be really interesting to ask where you see the sort of most optimism, where you see the most upside at the moment in that region, and how that investor landscape is evolving.
Well, it's very interesting because a lot of the trends in Asia are different, or at least express themselves differently than they do in the rest of the world. Maybe the best example is real estate. So around the rest of the world, we all wring our hands about real estate, and particularly office and whither office and how far have we fallen. Well, let me tell you, in Ginza, they're pretty full. You walk down the streets in Singapore and Orchard Road, boy, the offices are doing great. You know what else is doing great? Retail. They're going shopping, and there really hasn't been any fall in that at all. So the whole kind of repricing that we've had in parts of the real estate market in the Western world, we haven't really seen in Asia. And so we continue to see really interesting real estate opportunities. We're also seeing private credit really begin to come. I mean, many of the countries in Asia have been bank dominated for a long time, and that is starting to change. And so we're seeing the opportunity to originate private credit, and we're seeing a lot of the both sovereign wealth funds and pension funds that are decided to invest in it. So I would say those are the two areas that are really kind of different, and certainly been a focus for us in Asia.
That's interesting. And and I was also in the Middle East, which is also part of our Asia business, I think. You recently hired a new someone to head that, Mohammed Abdul Malik.
Very nice.
Very nice. And just great to hear sort of what was behind sort of your recent moves to the Middle East and what your ambitions might be for the next 5 to 10 years in that area.
So I think the Middle East is really one of the most dynamic and interesting regions in the world right now. And we've managed money for many of the sovereign wealth funds and family offices for many, many years. But what's happened more recently is that many of the governments and the sovereign wealth funds that they represent have wanted to find partners who are willing to help them develop their own markets. And I think that's a really exciting proposition. So rather than just hire asset managers to manage their money abroad, they actually want somebody to help them develop their own local real estate market. They want somebody to help, how do we build a deep, profitable bond market in our country? And so they're looking to people like us who have a lot of expertise in this and saying, how can you help us with our local economy as well as manage our money abroad? And we concluded as part of that in order to do it, we needed more local people in the Middle East who really understood the culture, the language, the way in which this could actually work and how we could be most useful to our partners out there. And that's certainly the rationale behind Mohammed's joining us and our opening offices out there over the next couple of years, which we really do believe will make a difference in how we're able to be true partners to many of these very large sources of capital.
Right. Yeah, so his role is more than a distribution or business development role. It's sort of a lot more wide-ranging than that.
It is. I mean, we aspire to be real partners and in the fullest sense of that meaning to large Middle Eastern players.
How interesting. Excellent. Maybe one final thing to ask you about. I wanted to ask you about leadership. I wanted to sort of, having steered through the pandemic, and as we talked about already, the recent volatility. what lessons from that time and your time at PGIM that you've taken already from that, what leadership lessons you have?
So I think that for any active manager, the culture is the most important kind of secret sauce that we have. In order to generate excess returns as an active manager, two things need to be true. I mean, first of all, you need an investment thesis that will turn out to be right. And secondly, you need it not to be priced into the market right now, right? So you need to have a non-consensus view. Getting either one of those right independently is actually not that difficult. Getting them both right together is tricky and requires a special culture, because you need a culture that will encourage and indeed support and make sure that you have unconventional views. And then it needs to be willing to support that unconventional view while it is wrong until it is right. Right. And because by definition, the market's being said, well, that can't be right. Here's the pricing of it. Wouldn't that can be true, whether or not that's how many times the Fed's going to cut rates or what's going to happen to value strategies. And if you aren't a manager who can both help people develop those views and then support people while they are wrong, then you might as well be an index player. And I think that is a true trick. And it requires a lot of trust. It requires a long-term philosophy about your people and your business. And it requires a certain humility, because you know that sometimes you're going to be wrong. Mm-hmm. And the last thing you want is for people, after they've been wrong, to feel that they can't be wrong again. Because we need them to have views that are not represented in the market. And that is a real leadership challenge. And people in my role in active managers, one of our main jobs is to reinforce that culture of supportive but highly challenging debates that results in non-conventional ideas.
Supporting people when they're wrong. I like that. I think that's a very interesting phrase. I'm interested to hear a little bit more about that, because that's quite challenging, because so much of what we do is predicated on measuring success as how many times you got things right. But of course, people, there's only a certain amount of tolerance for being wrong. I'm just interested to hear a bit more about what you mean by that, and how you would, is it about sort of getting them from A to B, or is it just allowing them to take risks, a certain freedom of thinking? What is it?
Well, you raise a good point. Part of an ability, I think, of backing people is also that you need a very strong risk management system. So all of the unconventional views that we take are taken within a quite conventional and extremely well-constructed risk management framework. And I think they need to go hand in hand, or you can go off the rails pretty quickly. But having said that, part of the art in judging investment performance is being able to know when you're wrong for the right reason. And what I mean by that is, I can tolerate people who the market hasn't kind of come to their point of view, but the investment thesis that they laid out is actually logical and it is working. It just hasn't worked yet. Versus an investment thesis where there's been style drift from it, or it hasn't actually delivered what we thought it was going to on the tin, in which case I'm a good deal less tolerant of that. So you really do need to be able to be quite nuanced about saying, what is failure? What is failure, but it's just going to succeed in a little bit more time? And then what really is just a matter of market timing, and you just need some patience. And the ability to judge between those takes, I think, experience. I mean, in some ways, I am in the business of judging judgments, and that is something that takes a good deal of pattern recognition.
You hear a lot about the benefits of diversity of thought. Do you think you have enough diversity of thought? It comes under, I suppose, the umbrella of diversity per se. But do you think you still have more further to go in that respect? And how do you try as an organization to encourage that? I suppose that's the question I really want to ask.
Yeah, I think we all want more diversity of thought. We do believe that we make better decisions when we have people who think differently about problems. And that's one of the ways you get unconventional ideas and ideas that are not yet priced in. And we all know that people think differently about problems and solve problems differently. And part of that may be their background and their education and then, you know, their prior experience. But part of it is that people process information differently. And you need people who are Cartesian thinkers and people who are more intuitive and people who, you know, have a liberal arts education and somebody who is a physics major. And all of that helps you, I think, get to a much better answer.
Fantastic. Well, I'll draw it to a close there. David, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And congratulations again on 25 years.
Thank you.